Many weeks ago, as we began this study on the attributes of God, we considered how that young lady who has been recently engaged might be flaunting her engagement ring. And the polite company is to comment, the polite thing to do is to comment on that ring, take notice of it, find something appropriate to say, but it's altogether different if a little jeweler guy catches a glimpse of the ring, puts in his eyepiece, and then begins to exclaim at how flawless and how beautiful and how brilliant this diamond is. And I trust that that is something of our experience as we come and look at the diamond of the person of God. For in God there is a complexity, in God there is a brilliance, in God there is a brightness. And we have seen that in our study of the attributes of God, it is not sufficient to simply look at one part of God and isolate that from the rest. For what happens if we try to focus on just one aspect of God and forget about the other parts? What if we only look at the love side of God? Well, there are going to be some very important balancing factors of God's holiness and of God's justice that are going to be left out of that view of God. And we won't be thinking about the God of the Bible at all. And then as well, we ask ourselves, what if you look at God's sovereignty, His ability to rule, and you forget to consider something of those balancing characteristics of His goodness, of His grace, and His love? Then you may, in your mind, make God out to be some sort of austere, strong being, someone who is more like a despot than the loving God that He is. And we have seen in our study of the attributes of God, we've looked at all of these generally, just one message. We're limiting ourselves to one message on most of these attributes of God. We see that there is a breadth of character in God. And we come once again this morning, our second study on God's sovereignty, to remind ourselves that sovereignty is the supreme and independent power and authority to rule. And when it comes to God, God's sovereignty is His supreme and independent power and authority to rule over all of His creation. One of the key passages that we'll look at this morning is Psalm 115. Our God is in heaven. He does whatever He pleases. A similar verse set against the backdrop of the idols of the world is that different from the false gods, different from the idols, whatever Jehovah pleases, He does in heaven and in earth, in the seas, and in all the deep places. God rules from His throne in heaven over everything. This is the message of Psalm 103 and verse 19. We noticed as we looked at this passage that it takes 18 verses for the psalmist to give something of the inspired setting of the sovereignty of God. There is a whole background. There is a context. But if we simply focus on verse 19, we get a graphic picture of God's rule. There is a throne. And there is a king on the throne. We find the divine origin of God's rule. It is that Jehovah has established His own throne. He didn't take a vote. He didn't take input as to whether or not He could, whether or not He was allowed. We see the absolute nature of His rule. He rules, and we find the universal extent of it. He rules over all. There are no exceptions as to the limitation of God's rule. And now this morning, in our study in the sovereignty of God, we want to take up a further thought, something of the freedom of God's goodwill and the limitation of God's goodwill. And I trust now that I don't have to touch anything. We'll just see that magically disappear with the improvements that our AVT guys have done. Thank you. Roman numeral 1, the freedom. The freedom of God's good and sovereign will. The freedom of God's good and sovereign will. And our first passage is Psalm 115, found on page 702 in the Pew Bible. Psalm 115 and verse 3. And if this outline looks a little bit different to you, with all those references listed out as A's and B's and C's, then what you're looking at is a sermon that got split in half. And so what was an A and a B and a C had to come out and be a Roman numeral 1, 2, and 3. And I think when this message goes longer than 15 minutes, you'll be thankful that it was split in half. The freedom of God's good and sovereign will from Psalm 115 and verse 3. Notice with me something of the context. Verses 1 and 2, there is glory that is to be given to God, not to us, O Jehovah, not to us, but to your name give glory. Because of your mercy, because of your truth, why should the Gentiles say, so where is their God? And now in verses 3 through 8 is the contrast of the living God to the idols. But our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. Eyes they have, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Noses they have, but they do not smell. They have hands, but they do not handle. Feet they have, but they do not walk, nor do they mutter through their throats. Idols are made in the image of the man who makes them. Idols have these various likenesses to a man, but the thing that is similar in each of these, they do not see, they do not speak, they do not hear. There's not even an inarticulate muttering that comes forth from the voice of these idols. They're dead. They're not living. But there is a God who is alive, and the God who is able to do all that he pleases. Now, verses 9 through 18 is the urging of Israel to bless God. O Israel, trust in Jehovah. He is their help and their shield. Verse 10, O house of Aaron, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. You who fear the Lord, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. The Lord has been mindful of us. He will bless us. He will bless the house of Israel. And so as we look at these verses, we see that Jehovah is our help and our shield. He has his people, and he focuses on them, and he cares for them. But we're looking here at the freedom of God's will. When God comes to decide what he is going to do, what does God say through the psalmist? He says, our God does whatever he pleases. There is not a poll that is taken among men. What should God do now? It's not the urgings of the great ones of the earth that tell God what they want God to do. But what we find is that Jehovah is free to act as he pleases. In verses 12 through 15, we find that even the great men are dependent on God's blessings. May God bless you with this. May God give you this. You're not blessing God. You're not giving anything to God. You're not even directing God. They are dependent on God. But now, secondly, B. Psalm 145 beginning at verse 10. This is page 722 in the Pew Bible. Psalm 145, our focus will be verse 10. But once again, as we come and we look at passages that speak of God's sovereignty, we want to notice something of the context. It's not that we're coming in and pulling some verse or some part of a verse out of the sense of its larger context. We don't want to do that. We want to see God's sovereignty in its native balance. So we find in verses 1 through 4 of Psalm 145 a resolution to praise God. I will extol you, my God, O King, and I will bless your name forever and ever. That's the length of it. How often will he do it? Every day I will bless you and I will praise your name forever. Great is Jehovah and greatly to be praised. But now notice with me in verses 5 through 13, here is a reflection on God's praise throughout the generations. And I want you to see something of the thinking and something of the speaking of this worshiper of the sovereign God. Verse 5, I will meditate, that's where it's going to start, on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. They shall utter the memory of your great goodness. You see how this, there is a verbalization of what we are seeing with the great works of God. Now, middle part, latter part of verse 7. And shall sing of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger, great in mercy. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all of his works. Now, verse 10. All your works shall praise you, O Jehovah, and your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and talk of your power to make known to the sons of men his mighty acts and the glorious majesty of his kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures throughout all generations. We've seen something of the reality of this spoken praise. But notice, once again, the content of this spoken praise. And here in Psalm 145, there is a concentrated emphasis on what God is doing, his great acts, his great works, that his rule, his kingdom, is one that goes on forever. But then notice with me verses 14 through 18, something of the complement to God's acts, to his sovereign rule. It is in verse 14, the Lord upholds all who fall and raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look expectantly to you, and you give them their food in due season. You open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all his ways, gracious in all his works. The Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. So what do we find in this psalm? We find that God is sovereign. He's got these great works, that the one who's got an eye for spiritual things will look at what God does and then end up verbalizing this that God has done. But now come with me to a proverb. We've looked at a couple of psalms now to the book of Proverbs, page 749 in the Pew Bible, Proverbs 21 and verse 1. And as you know, in the book of Proverbs, they are proverbs, and very often a verse stands all alone, and so it's not necessary to gain a lot of significance from the context. And that's what we find in Proverb 21 and verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of Jehovah. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. Now, who is more powerful than a king? He's not one of the little men of earth. The king is at the top. And all of the little people like you and me are dependent on the great one, the king. The kind of decision that the king makes in the realm of the economy is going to impact me as a little man, as a little person. The decisions that the king makes in relationship to foreign powers is going to trickle down and going to have its impact on me. So God is not talking here about monkeying with little ones like you and me. But he's talking of his rule, of his sovereignty over one of the great ones of the earth. And what is freer to a man than his heart? The king's heart. The heart is the source of all of our desires and of all of our plans. If we're going to do something out there, before we ever get to our hands actually doing it and our feet moving in that direction, that thing, that activity has been in our heart. It's been in the core of us. And so it is with this king. Before he ever starts a war, before he ever devalues his economy, it begins within. But then look further at our proverb. It's talking about rivers of water. It's really talking here not about a river that just naturally occurs, but it's talking more of an irrigation ditch in the midst of a parched region. So here is the farmer who one day is deciding, I want the water in my irrigation channel to go over into this field, and I'm going to leave it there all week. Now, how is he going to get the water to come out of the main channel and go over there? Well, in our day, they may have some button that they push, and a gate's going to go down that closes off this way and sends it over there. And maybe in a bygone era, there was a crank that you cranked and it raised the little gate and it sent the water over there. Or if you really want to get more primitive, you got a shovel in your hand and you pile up a pile of dirt here and the water goes over there. And then when it comes time, the farmer says, I need water in my fields over there. Either pushes the button, he turns the crank, or he gets a shovel with the dirt and he puts the dirt on this side and the water goes over there. The farmer doesn't have to be a brilliant individual with an IQ of 170. He can do this. He can get the water from here over to there. And so what do we have? We've got the heart of the king, of the great one, the core of his being, that which his counselors may not even know what's going on within. We've got that like the water channel. It's in the hand of God. And God is like the farmer standing there on his shovel saying, I've got enough water over here now. I'm going to send it over there. How hard is it for the farmer to send the water? How hard is it for God to direct the heart of one of the great ones of the earth? You see how this proverb is speaking in a graphic way of the absolute sovereignty of God. The heart of the king is in the hand of God. The hand, it's not even that God is going to have to get his shoulder into it and push with all of the thrust of his trunk and his legs. No, it's with his hand. He can take care of this matter that is in the heart of the king. Swaying a king to be involved in this war or not to be involved in this war. Swaying the heart of this king to be involved in these financial decisions. Now, fourthly, D. Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah chapter 10, page 794. If a few weeks ago, looking at the sovereignty of God, we focused on one passage, particularly one verse, Psalm 103, verse 19, this week you can see we're moving through in a Bible survey. So here we are, Isaiah chapter 10. This is a section in Isaiah's gospel where Isaiah is announcing judgment on Israel and then judgment on the various nations around Israel. And the question I want you to ask as I read a few verses here in Isaiah 10 is this. Who is ultimately in charge of the devastation of Jerusalem? There are two parties that are going to take credit for it. And then, notice as we read, God compares the king of Assyria to something. What is it that God compares the king of Assyria to? Isaiah 10 now, page 794, verse 12. Therefore it shall come to pass when the Lord has performed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his haughty looks. For he, the king of Assyria, says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom I am prudent. Also I have removed the boundaries of the people and have robbed their treasuries, so I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. My hand is found like a nest the riches of the people, as one gathers the eggs that are left. I have gathered all the earth, and there was no one who moved his wing, nor gathered, nor opened his mouth, even a peep. Shall the axe boast itself against him who chops with it? Or shall the saw exalt itself against him who saws with it? As if the rod could wield itself against those who lift it up, or as if the staff could lift up as if it were not wood? What is the king of Assyria's view of his power and influence? He says, well, it is of my great power and influence I've gone out and I've conquered this land and that land and the other land. And what's the particular imagery that he uses? He says, am I conquering of nations? It's like when Pat and Rachel walked into their chicken house and they pick up eggs out of the nest. It's not hard work. He says, you know, there's the riches in the nest and I want to take that in and sell it to my friends. I've got my eggs. You see, that's what the king of Assyria says. And is it following out that these nations, they didn't even peep? Is that a reference to what a chicken does when you bother them and want to get them off the nest and get the egg out from under them? That's what the king of Assyria is thinking of himself. But now God has a slightly different view of things. What God says is really going on is not that this great man of the earth has done it in and of himself, but God says, I've done it. Did you see it there in verse 12? When he has performed all his work on Mount Zion and Jerusalem, God is the one who did it. And now in verse 15, he refers to the king of Assyria as an axe, as a saw, as a rod, or as a staff. And what do all those things have in common? They're an instrument. And so God is claiming, though you see the king of Assyria carrying out this devastation, that king of Assyria is really my saw. He's my axe. He's my staff. And I have lifted it up and I have used him. It's very plainly pointing to the sovereign rule of God. He's not dependent on man. He will use men. He will use great men of the earth that will even lead to wars and the devastation with their proud hearts, but God is above all of that. Now, Isaiah. Once again, Isaiah. Now, Isaiah 29, page 815. We're going to begin reading here at verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will again do a marvelous work among this people, a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hidden. Woe to those who seek deep to hide their counsel far from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. They say, who sees us? Who knows us? Surely you have things turned around. Shall the potter be esteemed as the clay? For shall the thing made say of him who made it, he did not make me? Or shall the thing formed say of him who formed it, he has no understanding? What will God do to those among men who trust in their wisdom and their understanding, as if they are their own self-made woman, their own self-made man? They're independent from God. What is their self-sufficient hope? Well, I'm going to do this plan, and God doesn't know anything about it. I'm going to hide my secrets from God. How's that going to come along? And how does God view these great ones of men in verse 16? He views them as pieces of pottery. Not a real flattering thing for you or me. How big and important is man? Well, God thinks of them like a piece of pottery. And a piece of pottery ought to be smart enough, if it has any smarts, to know that a piece of pottery is made by a pottery maker. And when I read this passage and I think of the headlines that I've seen in just the last couple of days, where it speaks of how God is going to make the wisdom of the wise to perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hidden. When you read of a 65-year-old former Olympic decathlon champion has decided to transition into a woman. Oh. Why? Well, ultimately, because the understanding of their prudent man shall be hidden. As Romans 1 tells us, God gave them over to a debased mind. What a messed up world we live in. Where someone at age 65 says, I've been missing out on something for 65 years. I need to be a woman. F. Isaiah 45, page 837 in the Pew Bible. After prophesying of King Cyrus, whom God would use to restore Israel to her land, it's a prophecy. Cyrus is being mentioned in the Bible 115 years before he ever appeared on, well, even longer than that, before he appeared on the scene. Isaiah 45 and verse 5, let me get these early verses. I am the Lord and there is no other. There is no God besides me. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun to its setting that there is none besides me. I am Jehovah, and there is no other. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create calamity. I, the Lord, do all these things. Rain down, you heavens, from above. God is talking about a restoration to the land. And God is claiming that the announced devastation to come in about 100 years is a devastation that God has created, that God has planned. And then later on in this passage, God gives something of his view of man. Man is not real backward to complain when there's something in God's world that's going on that man doesn't like. And God gives this bit of advice to those who are complaining to him. Let the potsherd, verse 9, woe to him who strives with his maker. Let the potsherd, let the broken piece of pottery strive with the broken pieces of pottery of the earth. Shall the clay say to him who forms it, what are you making? Or shall your handiwork says, he has no hands? You see, our purpose of coming to this passage is simply to establish something of the freedom of God's good and sovereign rule. God is not asking man God is not dependent on man. But when we find that there is a trial, when there is a difficulty in our lives, when the curse of sin is being manifest to us, then we are to see that ultimately God stands behind that manifestation of the curse. It may be a health issue. It may be something that is breaking out in interpersonal relationship with your extended family. God is behind that. Well, why does He have it out for me? Well, it may be simply nothing more than that God is living out, God is evidencing what He said to Adam in the beginning, that in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. There will be consequences that come for all who will live in a sin-cursed world. But I invite you to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 34 in our survey, we want to see here something of the freedom of God's will. Daniel 4 is about King Nebuchadnezzar. He was the great king of Babylon. In Daniel chapter 2, in that vision of the very great kingdoms, Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. And you remember that Nebuchadnezzar was full of himself, and God said, if you aren't careful here, you're going to end up with the mind of a cow for 7 years. And that's what happens. Now, I want you to think back. Did God have to get Nebuchadnezzar's permission to give him the mind of a cow? And how did Nebuchadnezzar change in his thinking about himself and about God? Well, notice with me, Daniel chapter 4 and verse 30. This is his thinking before. This is his thinking when he's full of his own pride. Daniel 4 and verse 30. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? Seems like he might have left God out just a little bit. And where does he come? After the 7 years of having a mind of a cow, Nebuchadnezzar gives us his words in Daniel 4 and verse 34. He's come to bless the Most High and to praise and honor Him who lives forever. Now, the middle part of verse 34 begins with 4. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth, even if your name is Nebuchadnezzar, are reputed as nothing. He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain His hand or say to Him, what have you done? Now, it's pretty plain in Daniel chapter 4 that God is not dependent on input from man as to what God is going to do. No one can restrain His hand. Then real quickly, Ephesians 1 and verse 11, the latter part, Ephesians verse 1, page 1343. Here we have Paul's Trinitarian doxology for all the details of the wonderful salvation that God has planned, that the Son has given His life for, shed His blood, and the Spirit has sealed us to the praise of His glory. Why does God do these things? Why does God plan? Why does Jesus come and live and die? Ephesians 1 and verse 11 tells us, in Him also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestined according to the purpose of Him who works all things according to the counsel of His will. And if we trace out the original sense of those words, counsel and will, we might render it something like this. God has done what He has done according to the deliberation of his intuitive desire. Who did God consult with? His intuitive desire. Who did God take counsel with? His will. He did not counsel with the great men of earth. He did not counsel with me. He did not take counsel with you. But God is working all things according to the deliberation of his own intuitive desire. He did not consult angels. He did not consult the devil. He did not consult some law that is higher than God. He did not consult some law that is higher than God, that is the autonomy of man, that God can't mess with the independence of man. You see, we frequently hear that man is able to be whatever he wants to be, and that man can do whatever he wants to do. Well, somebody can do whatever they want to do. But it's not man. It's God. And as he does what he wants to do, he consults his own will. But now, secondly, Roman numeral 2. The limitation. The limitation of God's good and sovereign will. Is there any restriction on what God may do? We're looking at the freedom and the limitation. We have seen the freedom. No one can stay his hand. But now I want you to come back with me to Psalm 115. This is Psalm 115, page 702. Earlier, we focused on God's freedom. But our God is in heaven. He does whatever he pleases. But we want to go back now and see that there is some limitation to what God determines to do. Psalm 115 and verse 1. Not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory. Because of your mercy. Because of your truth. Why should the Gentiles say, so where is their God? When God is doing whatever he pleases, he has his own glory in view. When God is doing whatever he pleases, verse 3, he has his mercy, his chesed, his covenant faithfulness in view. He has his truth in view. But now verse 12. The Lord has been mindful of us. He will bless us. He will bless the house of Israel. He will bless the house of Aaron. When Jehovah decides what he's going to do, whatever pleases him, he is mindful that he is Jehovah. And he's mindful that as Jehovah, he has made a commitment to his people. And he will fulfill that commitment. So is there freedom on God's part? Yes. No one can restrain his hand. But does that mean that God is a despot who just does whatever whim comes to his mind? Well, in a sense, yes. But the whim that comes to God's mind is very informed. It's informed by his mercy, his glory, and his kindness. But now, Psalm 145, this is page 722. And here, we've seen God's kingdom. We've seen his mighty acts. But now we're asking why. Is there any limitation? Verse 8 to 9, Jehovah is gracious, full of compassion, slow to anger, great in mercy, great in chesed, great in that covenant faithfulness. Jehovah is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. Is there any limitation to what God is going to do? Yes. But it's a limitation that comes from the character of God. And I find here in Psalm 145 one more argument for the diamond illustration. You can't just look at God's sovereignty. For when the inspired writers are going to lead us and point out, do you see God's sovereignty? They're going to point out and say, don't you see right next to the sovereignty is this goodness? Is this love? Is this grace? Is this compassion? His tender mercies are over everything that he does. But now back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 4, page 1024, I think. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 25 and 30. Under the freedom of God's will, he does whatever he pleases. No one can say to him, what have you done? But why did God give Nebuchadnezzar the mind of a cow? Was it something just on a some sort of impulse? Was God merely being a bully to show that he could be a bully? Well, no, we find in Daniel 4 and verse 30 that God is contending with a proud man. Is this not Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power, for the honor of my majesty? And then we find in verse 25 that the God of justice has already warned Nebuchadnezzar through Daniel, but it is the God of justice speaking. Verse 25, if you don't humble yourself, they shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven 7 times, shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. The man is full of pride. And the man has been explicitly warned against that pride. So now when God comes and humbles the man, it's not something that God has done impulsively or despotically. He's done it as the God of holiness, the God of justice, the God of truth. And now see Daniel 4 and verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. So we see God's sovereignty in its balance of the other attributes of God. Final passage this morning, D, Romans 8, 28. Some of you may not need to turn to the passage. It's in your mind. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose. Here is the certainty of God's good sovereignty. We, like Paul, can know that God is ultimately in charge of everything. Here are the recipients of God's good sovereignty. Those who love God will be blessed. Those who love God have God committed to them. It's not a promise that is given to every man who will ever live. It is not a promise that is given to those outside of Christ and those that will suffer eternal destruction from the Son of Man as judge. It is to those who love God and have been called according to his purpose. But then notice the extent of God's good sovereignty. He causes how many things? All things to work together for good. So once again, when we're looking at the sovereignty of God, we are told, do not view it in isolation. Do not view God's rule as simply something that God is doing as a despot, but as a manifestation of his power that is joined to his goodness, to his generous heart. And what do we learn? Well, in the final minutes, come with me to Roman numeral 3, practical encouragements. Practical encouragements from God's good and sovereign will. The first lesson that we learn is A, the sovereignty of God promotes humility. Our natural tendency is to think that we are in charge. We tend to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. We tend to think of ourselves more highly as an employee at our place of work. We tend to think more highly of ourselves as a church worker. We tend to think more highly of ourselves than we ought as a family member. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was not the last one to ever think in terms of, is this not great Babylon that I have built by my mighty power? And we think, look what I've done at work. I am absolutely vital to this operation. Too bad that others don't see it quite so plainly. I am absolutely wonderful as a dad, as a husband, as a wife. Too bad the rest of the family doesn't value me quite the same way that I do. But instead of having dreamy notions of our greatness, we see the critical importance of God's designs and God's desires. Instead of saying, boy, are they lucky to have me around, we can honestly look at our strengths and we can trace it back. God was kind in giving me that and giving me the other. In Isaiah 40 and verse 14 and following, we see that the nations are regarded by God as a drop in the bucket. And if that's how God regards nations, how should you be regarding yourself? My wife doesn't know how well she has done in landing a guy like me. I am quite the good looker. I am quite the communicator. I am full of this, I'm full of the other. But the Bible takes us back to the sovereign purposes of God and says to us, for who makes you to differ from another? And what do you have that you did not receive? If you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? If you've got a good mind, who gave you the good mind? If you've got good verbal skills, who gave you those verbal skills? If you've got a cute face, who gave you that face? If you've got nice hair, who gave you that hair? If you've got a wonderful personality, who makes you to differ? If you're all excited about some part of your body, your legs, who gave you your legs? You see, we're wonderful creatures. We can take pride in anything. We can get all blown out of proportion. And even if we know that God gave me these wonderful legs, even if we know that, we'll still be quite proud to take pride in those wonderful legs. God says you're a piece of pottery made by the potter. You didn't make yourself. And you ought not to take credit as if God does not exist. A right understanding of the sovereign purposes of God will promote humility. What do you have that you did not receive? But God also has a huge part in your spirituality as well. We can easily begin to think that, oh, I'm not like all those morons of the world that are preoccupied with Super Bowl Sunday. I'm smarter than they are. I am more spiritually discerning than they are. Are you? Nor does anyone know the Father except the Son and the one to whom the Son wills to reveal Him. No one can come to me, Jesus said, unless the Father who sent me draws him. And I will raise him up at the last day. And Jesus said, Therefore, I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted to him by my Father. If you're a believer, why are you a believer? It's because God has reached into you and taken out the heart of stone and given you a heart of flesh. Now, can you take pride in that conversion experience? You can take pride in that you had a heart of stone? Are you going to take pride in the fact that God did the transplant? In Ephesians 2, it starts off with how we are dead in our trespasses and sins. But the transition to grace is the but. But God, who is rich in mercy because of His great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses and sins, He made us alive together with Christ and raised us up together. If you want to take pride for what God has done in your conversion, you've missed a significant part of what God does in conversion. Jesus said further, all that the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will by no means cast out. If you're not yet a believer, then you need to come to Jesus Christ in faith. And that's something that you need to do. But as you come in faith to Jesus Christ, owning your sin and get His perfect righteousness applied to your account, as you come to Jesus, then you need to know that God gave you to the Son before you came. The sovereignty of God promotes humility. But secondly, B, the sovereignty of God promotes trust. It's so easy for us to slip into thinking, I am a self-made man, I am a self-made woman. Why, the reason that I'm the only one that has gone to college in my family is because of my whatever. The reason that I have made it in my business is because of my rugged individualism. Or it is easy for some others of us to slip into a worrying fretfulness. And we're like Martha. And we take things on to ourselves and feel as though we have to worry everybody into their proper place. Jesus, tell my sister to get over here and help me because there's work to be done. Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things. But Mary has chosen the one thing that is needful, sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening to Him. Martha feels as though she's got to fix the problem with her sister. Psalm 37 tells us, do not fret. It only causes harm. Some of us like to think of ourselves as self-made. Some of us like to worry, or we slip into worrying. And others of us, it's particularly easy for us to plan like we were God. This is what I'm going to do later this month, and this is what I'm going to do next month, and this is what you're going to do to fit into my plan of what I'm doing later this month. And this is what I'm going to do next year. And King Nebuchadnezzar, as a great man, as a conqueror, he may have had a 3-year plan. And he may have had this on his calendar for the next year and the next 2 years. But you know what? When he's out there eating grass, none of that stuff on his calendar mattered. And the universe still went on. But some of us plan as if we were God. Proverbs 16:9 tells us, a man's heart plans his way. This is the broad direction that I'm going to go. But the Lord directs his steps. all the little itty-bitty steps along the broad way are organized by God. Do you see how the sovereignty of God promotes trust? The sovereignty of God is the bedrock of the Christian life. I serve a good God who is committed to my ultimate good. For we know that all things work together for good. Joseph had come to learn something of trust. And he learned to trust a sovereign God. He said in Genesis 50, verse 20, "But as for you, sinful brothers who sold me into slavery, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is today to save many people alive." There's a tendency to plan, the tendency to think that we're God, we're in charge, we're going to make it happen. Today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, "If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. Where is it that God is calling you to a greater trust? Is there some area in your life, perhaps, something going on at work and you're concerned that your whole position is going to be eliminated? What about your family life? Is there something of a trial that's going on? Something that is dominating your life? Do you think Joseph might have known something about painful trials in family life? Is there an interpersonal conflict that you can't fix? As much as you would want to and as much as you've prayed that it would get fixed, you can't fix it. Are you facing chronic physical pain that's just about to sink you into depression? Look to a sovereign God. Go to the sovereign God, and what a wonderful thing to be able to come in prayer to the sovereign Lord who has established his throne in the heavens and he rules over all. What a wonderful thing is with Philippians 4 to be able to come to God's presence and let our requests be made known to this sovereign God. And what's going to happen? And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. And hopefully at the end of that time of prayer, or hopefully at the end of 6 attempts at coming to this sovereign God in prayer, that we'll be able to say in Psalm 72:18, "Who only does wondrous things? God, why have we been uprooted as a family in northern Iraq, and why are we having to flee with nothing but the shirts on our back, and we're now in southeastern Turkey? Oh God, now I see. You wanted to expose us to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ and bring us to saving faith." What a wonderful thing to know that all things work together for good. What a wonderful thing to know that we may come and trust our Lord. And know that he's got our ultimate good in his mind. So we can come to this sovereign God and say with Solomon, "This is a good idea. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your path." We bless God for the freedom of His good and sovereign will, the limitation limited by His own character, and the practical encouragements that we would be more humble, that we would be more trusting of the sovereign God. Let's pray. Father, we do look to You as the one who sits on His throne. We would ask that You would help us as we face trials and difficulties, as we face unpleasant things that we don't even like to think about, and yet we're responsible to sort through some kind of mess. We pray, our God, that we would come to You with the confidence that You will help us, that You will direct us, that You'll not allow some trial to come to us that is greater than what we can bear. But with the temptation, with the unusual trial, You will also provide for us a way of escape. Father, bless us and strengthen us. Make us to be Your humble children, and make us to be Your trusting children. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen.